Yeah, we're a couple minutes late as we launch the final PFT Live. Not ever, but the last one before we take a three-week-plus hiatus. And it's good we're a couple minutes late because I may have missed an email that came at 12:01 p.m. Eastern Time from Bills GM Doug Whaley. Not only to me, a statement from Bills GM Doug Whaley sent to the entire Buffalo Bills releases email list. And we all know by now that Kiko Alonso, the Bills' great rookie linebacker in 2013, suffered a knee injury while working out on his own at Oregon. The final verdict is in, and this is straight from Doug Whaley. We have updated information regarding Kiko Alonso from yesterday. Unfortunately, he suffered a torn ACL in his left knee and will most likely miss the 2014 season. He will be scheduled for surgery in the near future and begin a rehabilitation program at the appropriate time. We feel badly for Kiko because he has worked very hard this offseason in preparation for the upcoming season, but we look forward to his return with his style of play that made him one of the league's outstanding rookies in 2013. Bottom line, no Kiko Alonso for 2014. Now, they could always carry him on the roster, and they could put him on the physically unable to perform list, and they could activate him later in the year without having to put him on the 53-man roster. There are ways they can do this and try to get him back, and I always am reminded of Rod Woodson in 1995, tore his ACL week one and played in the Super Bowl that year. That's the rare exception. Usually a guy gets shut down so he can focus on fully and completely rehabbing, and the team moves on for that season, and that appears to be what the Bills will do. Again, Whaley says most likely we'll miss the 2014 season. So I think we have to assume that we won't see Alonso. He was going to move from the middle to the outside this year, a weak side linebacker, with Brandon Spikes coming over from New England to play the middle. And now what do you do? What do you do if you're Buffalo? You hope the next man up can get it done. And also, once training camps open, we'll see guys get released. There'll be trade opportunities. There may be some guys from the Lions who are on the outs in Detroit, and Jim Schwartz, the new defensive coordinator, may decide to bring somebody over. So there are ways this can work out to the Bills' benefit, but the best possible outcome for the Bills would have been to have Kiko Alonso available for the 2014 season. And this is one of the reasons why I hate making predictions until the latest possible moment in the offseason. You start making predictions in May or June, and you know, when the schedule comes out, the networks that have the schedule release specials actually expect the people on the air to pick games that are going to be played in December. Are you kidding me? This is one of the reasons why you can't do it, because you never know when a guy's going to get hurt, whether it's on the field, whether it's off the field, whether it's working out on his own, playing basketball, walking down the steps, driving a car, doing whatever. A team's entire outlook can change like that. And for the Bills, who had plenty of optimism going into the season, that optimism needs to be tempered now, and it's going to be harder for guys like Whaley to convince the new owner not to make major changes because they've lost one of their key pieces of the defense that showed some promise last year under Mike Pettine and had higher expectations this year under Jim Schwartz. It's hard to say what the expectations are in Dallas on defense, but this is the ultimate break glass in event of emergency move. You know, the talk had been maybe they'll try to get Brian Urlacher to come out of retirement. Maybe London Fletcher would be an option. The Cowboys, to fill the hole at middle linebacker created by the torn ACL suffered during an OTA session by Sean Lee, have traded for Rolando McClain, a guy who retired last year at a time when it looked like he was going to be suspended. And then he unretired this year for one day of the offseason program and decided to quit again. Now the Cowboys send a six-round pick to Baltimore for Rolando McClain and a seventh-round pick. This is the ultimate Hail Mary pass when it comes to trying to shore up the roster. And this tells me that the Cowboys don't have a whole lot of faith in the guys they have on board and in position to replace Sean Lee. And you could say there's nothing to lose. Yeah, but you could say that about any move you make at this point. To bring Rolando McClain out of twice retirement when he has shown no inclination to play, and I know he's saying all the right things now. We'll see if it lasts once it's time to put the pads on. And we'll see if he can stay committed to football. But it just shows how desperate the Cowboys are right now to get this thing fixed with Sean Lee done for the year. Desperation is going to be the operative word as of Thursday, because that's the day the ruling is coming on the Jimmy Graham grievance. And since we won't be on the air tomorrow, we will be on NBCSN, and we won't be back until after the July 15 deadline for signing Jimmy Graham to a long-term deal. I want to offer my prediction of what is going to happen, and it's a flowchart, okay? If the Saints win their grievance, well, it's the Graham grievance. If the Saints win this thing and Jimmy Graham is considered a tight end, that's a $7 million franchise tag salary for Graham in 2014. I don't believe the appeal would be resolved by July 15 because Graham is the one who could have filed this thing back in February. Graham waited. If he tries to get an expedited ruling on appeal by July 15, I think they're going to say no thank you. You're going to have to go ahead and try to do a long-term deal knowing that you've lost at the initial level. And I think in that case, Graham and the Saints work out a long-term deal on or before July 15 with Graham making $7 million this year under the franchise tag. That becomes the starting point for a long-term deal. Let's say he gets $9 million a year on his long-term contract with the Saints. If Graham wins on Thursday, however, I think the situation gets far more complicated. I think that at that point, with Graham holding the leverage with a $12.3 million salary subject to appeal, I think first the Saints would have a stronger argument to get the appeal resolved by July 15 so they know what they're dealing with when it's time to work out that contract. I think the Saints would ask for an expedited appeal, and I think they'd have a better chance to get that expedited appeal because they're not the ones who dragged their feet from late February into the middle of April in filing the grievance. If they can't get an expedited ruling on appeal, I don't know that the two sides can work out a long-term deal with Graham holding that hammer, that $12.3 million. And, you know, this will be the ultimate pushback against a Saints organization that always waits until the last minute to get these deals done, that always forces the players to wait and wait and wait and wait. And now the player has a huge piece of leverage. I don't see Jimmy Graham giving it up because, you know what, if he wins on appeal, $12.3 million this year, over $14 million next year if they tag him again, over $21 million in 2016. I think Graham ends up hitting the market next year, and then we find out what he's really worth. And it doesn't matter whether he's a tight end or a receiver at that point. What matters is what someone else will pay him. We could see him on the market come March if he wins tomorrow. So that's kind of how I think it's going to go. And as to the grievance itself, I think Graham's going to win. And here's a very simple reason why. The CBA says what it says. You're tagged at the position where you participated in the most plays in the prior year. Those slot snaps, I think, count as receiver because under the Saints' argument that that's an extension of tight end, you could line a tight end up in the slot 100% of the time and still treat him as a tight end. I don't think that's what the CBA means. And also, 2 years ago, Drew Brees had a very weak grievance that he was using to apply leverage to the Saints to get his long-term deal. I thought Brees had no chance of winning. And he won. Graham's got a much stronger case now than Brees had 2 years ago. I think Graham's going to win, and we'll see what happens. If I'm right, I'll remind you of it on July 15. If I'm wrong, I'll hope you have all forgotten it by the time we're back on July 15. We'll be back from break sooner than July 25 when we return from our hiatus. And when we come back, Scott Baer of CSN Bay Area will join us to get us up to date on the Raiders. The Raiders are the one team I look at and I say they got no chance to win the Super Bowl. Every other team, you could make a plausible argument. The Raiders, you can't. I'll see what Baer thinks of that. Also, what he thinks of whether or not we'll see Derek Carr or Matt Schaub week one and how long we'll see Schaub if he's the guy. And then finally, we'll talk to you one last time. I'm going to miss you, kind of, for the next 3 weeks. So you can call today and you can tell me how much you will or won't miss this program. We'll do that to wrap the show. Before that, Scott Baer. Before that, we'll take a break. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. Rolando McClain is coming back to the Raiders, sort of. The Cowboys and the Raiders will get together for training camp practices this year. And Rolando McClain used to play for the Raiders. He was a top 10 pick a few years ago. Did you see how I deftly moved my computer out of the screen? It sneaks in from time to time. Don't want to do any free advertising for the maker of this silver sleek laptop that I have. Joining us now to help us get up to date on the silver and black, and I want to start with Rolando McClain, Scott Baer of CSN Bay Area. Based on what you know of McClain from his time with the Raiders and based on how McClain's career in Baltimore fell apart, do the Cowboys have any chance of getting anything out of this guy?
It's going to be interesting because we've seen these starts and stops before when he was in Baltimore. And what, even this spring, I think there was supposed to be a comeback for the offseason program that didn't work out. So, I mean, I never have a lot of confidence in how these things go, especially when, you know, he's been out and then back and out and back, and how it ended in Oakland definitely wasn't good. Now, there's a lot of turnover on the Raiders offensive roster especially. But, I mean, head coach Dennis Allen did suspend him indefinitely. There was an argument on the practice field that kind of was the beginning of the end there. So I don't think there's going to be any love lost. And there will be pads, but there won't be tackling. So it'll be interesting to see that will at least be a point of contention during the Raiders' trip to the Cowboys' training camp facility for some joint practices in mid-August.
And if nothing else, it's going to be a reminder of the team's failings when it comes to using its draft picks, particularly first-round draft picks in recent years. I have a theory that when I look at the Raiders right now and I consider their schedule and everything that's going on with the organization, I see the Raiders as the one team where you can't make a plausible argument that they have any chance of winning the Super Bowl this year. Do you believe that there's no way that the Raiders can make it? And I know the more I say this, the more I'm tempting fate that they'll win the Super Bowl this year. But do you see a chance right. That the dots connect in a way that the Raiders could get to the Super Bowl and win it this year?
I mean, I think that's incredibly difficult. I think there's been some odds makers that have said they're only going to win, you know, 4.5 games, 5 games. I think that might be a little low, but I don't think that you can go from 4-12, complete roster turnover, without a real strong foundation to go right to the playoffs, or especially a deep run to the Super Bowl. I just think that's unrealistic. At the same time, their talent level is on paper. Now, everybody has to stay healthy for that, you know, piece of paper to look the same in December that it does right now. But there's more talent on this team. There's more measured excitement on this team, Mike, and I'm being careful with my words here, especially when I'm talking to a former lawyer, that I do think they believe they're going to be better. I honestly believe that they're going to be better. How much better? I think that's going to be the debate for the summer.
How much better will they have to be to save jobs? You can look at it and say Mark Davis, the owner of the team, getting impatient. GM Reggie McKenzie could be on the outs. Coach Dennis Allen could be on the outs. But then there's the idea of buying out contracts, hiring someone as good or better. I feel like Mark Davis doesn't have the desire to write those checks. Is there a number that you have in mind, a threshold number of wins that would ensure McKenzie and Allen would be back for 2015?
I think it's a little bit different for each guy. I think when you looked at Dennis Allen, I think that you're looking at more of a hard win count. And again, this is just me talking. This isn't anything that, you know, Mark has said. He's actually kind of distanced himself from the football side of things, saying, hey, this is Reggie's deal. So if he's got to make tough moves, he can say, all right, well, my football people didn't work out. So with Dennis, I've kind of been shooting for the 7-win range, which you never want to aim below 500 or anything like that. But I think that would show signs of progress, especially when you're factoring in the toughest strength of schedule, in the NFL, having to play the AFC West and the NFC West. That's difficult. But in terms of Reggie, I think it's a little bit different because there's so much optimism around this particular draft class, especially when there hasn't been in years past. He's only had one other first-round draft pick before he drafted Khalil Mack, number 5, and that was DJ Hayden. We all know he's still hurt, but I think that from top to bottom, there's a lot of people that think that this draft class could be pretty good. And if it ends up making that immediate impact, Hayden can stay on the field in the second round. Right tackle Malik Watson can be a starter. I think that would go a long way in showing Mark Davis, hey, we have a talent evaluator here that deserves to stay and continue to build this foundation. Now, I'm sure that you notice how many ifs were in the last sentence that I just had, quite a few, because a lot of things have to go right for this team to make some upward, you know, progress and mobility, you know, especially against such a daunting schedule.
And one of the key questions that will determine the team's success or lack thereof is who plays quarterback. And Matt Schaub was given $8 million-plus guaranteed to come in this year and have the job. And we periodically hear that second-round quarterback Derek Carr may have a chance to play sooner rather than later. Who's going to make the decision as to which guy plays quarterback week one, or make a change from Schaub presumably to Carr at some point after the fact if Schaub wins the job?
Now, that's a really interesting question, Mike, because you could have just asked me, hey, you know, does this guy have a chance to beat out Matt Schaub despite all this guaranteed money that you mentioned? Your question is a lot more interesting, and I think something that could really be debated for longer than our segment, because I think it's going to come down to a confluence of factors here, especially with jobs on the line and things like that. The one thing that the Raiders have always shown is that they don't really care much about your draft status or about how much guaranteed money that you're making. If you're not the guy that should be starting, if you look at Matt Flynn last year with, I believe, $6 million guaranteed, he started half of one game and fell out of favor rather quickly. Now, you know, there were some grumblings that owner Mark Davis had something to do with Terrell Pryor moving into that starting role maybe faster than expected. The other side of it is that Dennis Allen and offensive coordinator Greg Olsen could see that Matt Flynn didn't have his arm right, which apparently is only fit for the Green Bay Packers system. Who knew? But I do think that it's going to be several different people that have influence with that. The one thing that I've seen is that the coaches are really pushing all in on Matt Schaub, especially early, despite the fact that they've chosen to accelerate, as they're using the term, accelerate Derek Carr's progress by giving him more reps and more responsibility earlier than they expected.
And, you know, I look at that decision to take Carr in the first place, and I say for a team that seems to be trying to win now, as evidenced by all the veterans who were acquired in free agency, why would you use that high second-round pick on a quarterback and not on someone who can come in and make an impact on the team right away? Do we know who it was that ultimately wanted Carr?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was pretty clear that owner Mark Davis was saying, hey, what if we just take Derek Carr number 5? But I think that really in a perfect world, they wanted Khalil Mack more than anything, and they were going to try to trade out of that pick. I think that you actually mentioned that Mike Evans was higher than Sammy Watkins, and I did some research, and you were right on that come on draft day. But I think that when Derek Carr fell to them, I don't think they really had an option because that they thought that value at number 36 was so high that they had to go with him because they were going to trust and stick with their draft board more than they were going to go to a position of need. Now, before the draft, I'd been pitching, hey, don't draft a quarterback at all because you need so many, you know, you need so much help at so many different spots. And I think it took a lot of gumption to take Derek Carr at number 36, especially when you look at this wide receiver core, this group of playmakers in the passing game, and there isn't a lot of firepower. It was only James Jones that was added, and he's a very good player. He's caught a bunch of touchdowns, but you don't have that stretch-the-field speedster that I think that they desperately wanted, and I think that they've been sort of inferring that they wanted a more explosive tight end. They wanted a more explosive wide out, and I think despite the rush on wide receivers in the first round, there were some decent ones there for the taking at number 36. So, again, it's about sticking to the draft board, going with your gut and realizing. And what I thought was pretty impressive is when you have all these guys on the hot seat that are making these calls in the war room, they still took a quarterback that they didn't think could realistically help them right away or that they weren't planning on helping them right away, that they were still drafting for the future. They were still doing the academically, at least, right thing, as opposed to getting that playmaker on the outside that might help them more immediately.
One of the bigger issues that affects the franchise, not necessarily this year, but definitely beyond this year, is the status of the stadium effort. There's been a claim from the A's of a 10-year lease at the O.co Coliseum. What does that mean for the Raiders if that lease gets finalized?
Yeah, and there's been some interesting talk actually this morning, Mike, because they were supposed to vote on a 10-year lease last Friday, and then in typical, I wouldn't say typical Oakland fashion, but in typical kind of politicians' fashion, some of the people that were supposed to vote and approve that lease boycotted the meeting, and now they're coming back with a fresh new lease that the city's kind of sort of leaking to the San Francisco Chronicle out here, but you never know how the A's feel about it. It's kind of a circle. And what that means for the Raiders, Mark Davis has said more than anything else is, hey, just guys, can you figure out what you want to do so I at least know what kind of playing field that I'm on? Because he wants to build on that Coliseum site, and the only way that you're going to do that is to knock the existing building down. Now, within this 10-year lease, supposedly there are out clauses aplenty for the team, for the city, in terms of notification for if the team's going to leave or if the Raiders build something on the existing footprint, because there's a pretty big parking lot there, and the Golden State Warriors are not long for that site either. So it could complicate things. I don't think there's any doubt about it. Now, Mark Davis, he talked to some of us at the end of minicamp. He's saying all the right things, like, hey, you know, the A's and Raiders are not rivals. But I don't think there's any way that you can avoid seeing this as a complicating matter. And frankly, it always has been. You know, it was so common to have these multi-use stadiums, but now baseball and football are very strange bedfellows, especially without a lot of other options in the East Bay. So it's going to be interesting. I think it's complicating. It is a snag. And it will be interesting to see how the Raiders react moving forward, because the one thing is that, and I'll try to keep this short for you here, Mike, is that they've been working with a developer trying to build this Coliseum City, this huge kind of new development. And with the Raiders and hopefully the A's as centerpiece, well, the A's have their own plans in mind and haven't been working with the same level of interest as the Raiders have. And when you have those conflicting interests, oftentimes you spend more time fighting and less time developing.
The reality for the A's right now at their stadium is they have a lease for one more year. They could leave after this season. And I think if you're going to move a team, you can't say you're going to move it. You just have to move it. Is there any chance we dog paddle on this stadium issue through the 2014 season? We get to early 2015 and out of the blue, Mark Davis says, we are moving to L.A. or Portland or somewhere else.
I mean, it's his right, given his ability to have worked out that short-term lease extension. I guess it's possible, but, you know, again, you have to read through what people are saying on this, because I don't think that he would ever come out and say that now. That does him no good. And it's always possible, but, I mean, he's had so much conviction about staying here, at least publicly, that he says he wants to exhaust every option. And I used to cover the Chargers and Dean Spanos down there. I said the same thing, and Dean Spanos has been pretty true to his word, trying to find a stadium option despite having that out clause in San Diego. Now, Mark has an easier path, so I would say anything's possible, but I haven't seen any direct signs that he's been willing to do that. I think he'd want a stadium plan in place, just like anybody else going to L.A. or anything like that, before he pulls the trigger.
And would it be L.A. or would it be somewhere else if the team ever does move?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, the subtle hints that Mark has dropped, and it's absolutely true, is that the Raiders have a lot of fans in Southern California, and that Inland Empire in Los Angeles, that's probably the most popular team down there even still. So L.A. could make a lot of sense. I don't know anybody that would want to go back into the L.A. Coliseum again, right? That doesn't sound fun. But, yeah, I mean, with these short-term leases, he's got some options. But the one thing that I do know is that and I can't really blame the guy. He's been increasingly frustrated by the lack of progress. And he's been told several times, all right, well, by this date, expect some progress. By that date, expect some progress. And those dates keep passing without much going on here. So, I mean, something's got to happen. That Oakland Coliseum has been there since 66, and we all know about the sewage problems and the – you know, tiny scoreboards, and the fact that if you're talking state-of-the-art facility, the Oakland Coliseum is the opposite of that. So, I mean, something's got to happen here, because just like any team, they need those luxury dollars. It's just a matter of working a deal out. And, I mean, he has said, you know, for everybody else wanting to leave, the A's, you know, aren't going to San Jose, but they'd like to go. The Warriors are going across the bay to San Francisco, that he's the only one willing to put up, you know, it's still not all of the money, but a decent amount of money to stay here. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how the city prioritizes who they want to keep. You know, it's always tough. The A's get 81 home dates, and an NFL team only has 10. So it'll be interesting to see how all that stuff factors in. But this thing definitely isn't over yet.
Well, short-term and long-term issues of intrigue for the Oakland Raiders as they try to get back on the right side of 500. They had a couple of 8-8 years. We'll see if they can get within sniffing distance of 8-8 this season. We'll see where they're playing come next season. We'll check out your work continuously at csnbayarea.com. Thanks for giving us some time, Scott.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, there he is. Scott Baer, csnbayarea.com. And You don't have to wait until July 25 to find out whether or not I was right or wrong about the Jimmy Graham grievance. We'll have the answer for you after the break. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. We'll also talk to you, so call up. I forgot to do that part. I got so excited about the Graham ruling. 888-237-5269. You can either tell me that I was right or tell me that I was wrong. Not that I need anyone to tell me, and I'll tell you whether I was right or wrong after the break, whether you call me or not. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. Well, arbitrator Stephen Burbank had said that he would issue a decision no sooner and no later than Thursday on the question of whether or not Saints tight end Jimmy Graham is a tight end or a receiver for franchise tag purposes. And someone in the league office has gotten their hands on the ruling, and part of the victory lap was leaking to a league employee in Rappaport the outcome. And the outcome is that Jimmy Graham is a tight end for franchise tag purposes, which means my prediction was wrong, which means it's not the first time this year, this month, or this week that I was wrong. But hey, at least I was willing to go out on a limb, and I thought it was a sturdy limb. As it turns out, it broke under my weight, and I'm now laying in a crumbled mass at the bottom of the tree. And Jimmy Graham has to be feeling the same way, in part because his head coach testified against his position, essentially taking $5.3 million out of Graham's pocket for 2014. It's going to be awkward, to say the least, to see how this all plays out for Graham and the Saints. But now keep in mind where we go from here. Graham has the ability to appeal this. And if Graham tries to get a ruling before July 15, the three-person panel charged with the obligation of resolving this could say to him, hey, Jimmy, 4th of July is coming up. We got vacations. We got stuff going on. We're not going to force this thing to a conclusion by July 15 when you could have filed your grievance back in late February, the moment that the tag was applied in a way that you deemed to be incorrect. You took full advantage of having up to 3 years, and yes, he really could have waited up to 3 years to file that grievance. He waited 2 months, and now he's put folks in a bind if he wants to try to get an expedited appeal. So what do you do? Do you go forward with the appeal? And the appeal, the possibility of winning on appeal, is your fallback in the event you can't work out a long-term deal. And even though he's going to get $7 million this year under the franchise tag, I think the Saints would pay him in the neighborhood of 9 to 10. Will he take that? Or will he roll the dice again, hope that the three-person panel will overrule Stephen Burbank? They very well could. It's going to be a dilemma here, but I think Graham, based on how he has been wired to date, will do his best deal by July 15 and move on, unless he really is upset about the way the Saints have handled it. And, you know, sometimes a guy who's slow to anger, when he finally gets there, it's like he turns green and his shirt rips off and he storms the countryside. It'll be interesting to see Jimmy Graham's reaction on Twitter. And also, keep an eye on this. I was told over the weekend that if Graham loses and the Saints win, there will be players, at least one, I don't know if this is a Saints player or some other prominent player, who will be unloading publicly on Sean Payton for testifying against Graham. Now, obviously, if it's a Saints player, it's going to move the needle a lot more. If it's not a Saints player, we'll see whether or not it cajoles any Saints players into chiming in. But I think one of the questions that's going to be asked is, would other coaches do this to one of their players? Would other coaches testify against a player with $5.3 million on the line? We'll see what happens with that. Now let's see what questions you have. Sorry for the detour. A fairly important bit of news at a time when we're talking about whether or not Warren Sapp was justified in leaving a tip at a sports bar in Florida. First question, what kind of tip will Nick Foles get? That comes from at DaddyD1170. Will Nick Foles get a contract extension, and where do you think it will fall compared to other quarterbacks? Well, it's all to be determined because Nick Foles only has a limited number of NFL starts. He'll be a full-time starter for the first time this year. Will he stay healthy? Will he be injured? Remember last year he missed some time with a concussion. Will he be effective? Will defenses catch up with him? Will he still continue to have an ungodly ratio of touchdowns to interceptions? We will know a lot more about Nick Foles' value after the season. And here's the thing. This is one of those situations where the Eagles would be wise to try to buy low and put money on the table now to get Foles to take it before they get themselves in a corner. They can't. Nick Foles only has 2 years of service. Under the current labor deal, you have to have 3 years before you can do a new contract. So both sides have to ride out that third-round slotted deal that Foles did back in 2012, and we'll see where he is after the season. And then it'll be whether or not the Eagles do want to work something out, knowing that they still have him for one more year under contract after 2014. And let's go to the phone line. Taylor in Wyoming, you're on PFT Live. What's up, Taylor?
Hey, what's up, man?
How are you, buddy?
I got a question.
What I got an answer. I got an answer if you got a question.
What do you think the chances of the Chargers making the playoffs are now that we got Brandon Flowers on our defensive end?
Well, you got Brandon Flowers, and you also have Justin Gilbert. Not Justin Gilbert. Jason Verrett. Justin Gilbert's a Brown. Not yet. He hasn't signed. Jason Verrett, another corner taken in round one. And if you're going to play and survive in that AFC West and also have a chance of beating teams out of the division, you better have a good secondary. They have made the investment in San Diego to try to make that happen. And look, last year no one expected them to get to the playoffs, and they did in the first year of Tom Telesco and Mike McCoy as the GM and the head coach. This is year two, and I think we'd have to assume that they can continue. And I would also assume they like the fact that they're flying under radar and no one's really talking about them. So it's going to be hard to put them on the outside. And we know that half the teams out there that made the playoffs last year on average won't make it back. In the AFC West, I'd say it's far more likely the Chiefs are on the outside looking in and the Chargers move up the second in the division and possibly another wild card berth. We'll stay with the phone lines. We appreciate getting the phone calls on our last PFT Live until July 25, and we'll go to John in Portland. John, what's up, pal?
Hi, Mike. I'll miss you over the next 3 weeks.
Sure you will.
I wanted to ask you, how fair do you think the offensive pass interference penalty is? Because right now it's just a 10-yard penalty, and just like holding. And defensive pass interference is a spot foul. So if you're like on your 30-yard line and you chuck it 50 yards down the field and there's offensive pass interference, it's only a 10-yard penalty, but a defensive pass interference is a 50-yard penalty. I think it should be a spot foul either way.
Well, but how do you do a spot foul? Do you reward the interception to the other team? Is that what you do? I mean, you can't make it a spot foul. Do you go 50 yards the other way?
You go 50 yards the other way.
Oh, no, that's not going to work. I like where you're at. I don't like the solution. I like the solution better of allowing, since it's a judgment call anyway, of allowing the officials to say the ball would have been intercepted. That may not be a popular view, and I know they're getting away from that. What would have happened? Remember, they took away the rule several years ago. If a guy catches a ball at the sideline and he's pushed out of bounds, if they think he would have gotten 2 feet down, they'll give him the catch. They don't do that anymore. I think it would be hard to say, well, yeah, that defensive back would have caught the ball if he hadn't been wiped out by the receiver. The guy plays defense for a reason, after all. But I like that better than pushing the offense back 50 yards. Just treating, hey, okay, here we go. That guy had it lined up. He got wiped out. This would have been an interception, but for the foul, we're going to give him the ball. I mean, we say it would have been a catch, but for the foul. We don't know that the guy would have caught it. So maybe that's the way to do it. If you do have a situation, it would be very hard to police, but if you have a situation where it's offensive pass interference on a guy who's otherwise in position to catch the ball, why not treat it as an interception? That would be the fair bookend to offensive or to defensive pass interference, and I'd never really thought about that before. So, John, thank you for giving us a question that raises an issue that I don't know that anybody's even debated this. It used to be 15 yards for offensive pass interference. It's now 10 yards. Should it be an interception at the spot of where the offensive interference occurs, if it's truly the offensive interference that occurs when the ball's coming in and the defensive back is there and he's ready to catch the ball? Interesting stuff, unlike most of the stuff that I typically have to say. So good stuff. Another phone call. Jason in Cincinnati, you're on PFT Live. What's up, Jason?
Hey, what's up? My question is you've been on the Johnny Manziel was going to be the starting quarterback from day one for the Browns, and you point to that they shouldn't get into another situation in 2007 when Anderson was freewheeling and going. But the point I have is Quinn couldn't play. If Manziel can't play like Quinn could, why don't we take the chance with Hoyer and have the joy of them maybe going to the playoffs or maybe getting a 10-7 record that they haven't had since 2007?
Well, that's a great point, but they didn't know Quinn couldn't play. Now, they may have found out Quinn couldn't play very quickly. Quinn wasn't ready to be put on the field because he held out deep into training camp, and they gave up on Charlie Fry after a week one debacle, and they went with Anderson because Quinn wasn't ready. And it created a situation where Anderson played so well, it thrust the whole thing into a mess, and they never recovered from it. If you believe Manziel can play, and obviously you do, or you don't trade from 26 to 22 to get Manziel, then you get him ready and you get him on the field and you avoid a situation where Hoyer strengthens his grip on the job and you are delayed in your effort to get Manziel on the field. But you know what? Since the topic has come up, I'm now wondering whether or not Manziel is jeopardizing his opportunity to start week one based upon his open defiance of owner Jimmy Haslam. And that's exactly what it is. When Haslam reportedly wants Manziel to tone it down, and his version of toning it down is hanging out at a party with Justin Bieber, and we reported today on PFT, I talked to somebody who was at that party, there were underage girls present at the party. You are playing with fire if you're Johnny Manziel in that situation, and you're defying your owner, and maybe the only thing to do, maybe the only way to get a message across to him is say, hey, Johnny, Brian Hoyer is going to be our guy. And it's putting, here's what it does. It puts more pressure on Manziel. We talk all the time about guys betting on themselves. Manziel has gone all in on his football abilities because if he doesn't play well, he's not going to start. And if he doesn't perform well in practice, and if he doesn't play well when he's on the field, everybody's going to say it's because of his lifestyle. So he is really putting himself in a corner on this question of whether or not he's going to end up being a great player because his lifestyle will be blamed if he's not. And another phone call before we take our three-week hiatus. Steven in Chicago, what's up, buddy?
Yo, Mike, how you doing, bro?
Good, man.
Quick question. I'm not sure you're aware, but they say back in the 90s, there were private prison investors who directed the rap era into this violence, okay? Now, this was for these gentlemen to cash out. Now, I totally feel the NFL does the same way by trying to justify that these people can get less guaranteed money, so to say, like the new contract, Avery Bradley, and they justify it by saying there's 52 players on the field. Don't you think that dilutes their work? Don't you think that they're really cashing out? $11 billion industry. You're telling me a man who's been a backup for quite a few years is getting more guaranteed money because there's 11 or 15 players compared to 52? This stuff doesn't make sense to me, man. What is the NFL really up to?
Well, you know, you raise a great point. And the bottom line is the players, in an effort to get true free agency, and that was something they wanted for decades, we want the ability to go from team to team. The players agreed to a salary cap that limits the number of dollars that are available in any given year, in every given year, for a team. And you see the teams use that as a way to cajole guys into taking less money because we need to have money available for other players. It worked on Colin Kaepernick. He did a bad deal for himself, in my opinion, for a variety of reasons, reasons we've already discussed here and I won't bore you with again. But guys get that whole, you know, there's the concept of team. It's a team sport and we're in this together and we want to build legacies and win championships. And then there's the individual who wants to get paid. And the individual player has a lot more in common with the owner than the team collective does, because the individual who's trying to get paid is acting like that owner who put himself in position to own a team by doing everything he could do in every possible instance to get paid. That's why I'm a firm believer, and it's taken me a while to get to this point, because it's a tough mental exercise to get around. But look, you got a limited number of years, ever-present risk of injury, serious injury at times. Get paid what you can and do what you have to do within the confines of the rules, whether it's holding out, whether it's waiting until the last possible minute to sign your franchise tender and show up week one, whatever is available to you. I'm a firm believer in doing it because the owners will do whatever is available to them. And we'll continue with another phone call before we wrap it up for the next 3+ weeks. Blake in Houston, you're on PFT Live. What's up, Blake?
Yes. Well, I was wondering, okay, we know that Vernon Davis is holding out, but he'll probably return to the 49ers at some point. So with Vernon Davis and the addition of Stevie Johnson, does that make the 49ers have the best receiving corps, including tight end, in the National Football League? And is this going to finally propel them to a Super Bowl victory?
Well, you know, it's a great observation when you think about it, and thank you for the call. Vernon Davis shows up. Michael Crabtree's still there. Stevie Johnson arrives. Anquan Boldin is still on the team. Not a bad group of receivers. And you've got a quarterback who's very motivated now to push back against the criticism that he did a bad deal. Yeah, a lot of people think that this is just the natural progression. They've been knocking on the door the last few years, and this is the year to kick it in. The thing that gets me, though, is even if Davis does fold the tents and show up for the start of training camp, a lot of turmoil, a negative vibe throughout the 49ers organization, whether it's the Aldon Smith situation, and I guarantee you he's not going to be available week one. The question is, how many weeks does he get suspended, assuming he isn't thrown in jail? And I don't think he will be thrown in jail when he's sentenced later this month. You've got other off-field issues that have happened this year. You've got the Jim Harbaugh contract. How much longer does he really want to be with that team? Can they work something out with him? There's just a sense of calm with the Seahawks that isn't there with the 49ers. And I think Jim Harbaugh is sufficiently skilled as a head coach to take that turmoil and find a way to channel that in the right direction. So I'm not ready to write off the 49ers. This could be the year that they make the next logical step. They do have a great core of receivers. They do have some great players. They're going to find a way to have a chip on their shoulder, not just because the team in their division that they've been battling with the last few years is in possession of the most recently minted Lombardi Trophy. So it's interesting stuff. All the more reason to pay closer and closer attention to the NFL. The soccer's out of the way now. I know they're still playing the games, but do we really care now that the U.S. is knocked out? I would submit no. The next major event is the opening of training camp, and we'll be back on the air just in time for it all to get started. And just because PFT Live is shutting down for the next 3 weeks, and thank you so much for your calls today, I take that as a sign that maybe you will miss having this program around for 3.5 weeks. We will still be with you at ProFootballTalk.com on a continuous basis. I'm going on vacation next week, but I'm going to have my laptop with me, and we're going to be posting content. I got the five guys who do a great job of putting stories up when I'm doing other things. So we will have plenty of content at ProFootballTalk.com all through the month of July, plenty of stories to keep track of. So I will miss you for the next 23 days, but I'll see you back here. Hopefully I'll have a little bit of a tan for a change on July 25. There's only one way to find out. Tune in July 25. Until then, have a great one. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you soon.